Welcome everyone to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 53, right at the beginning, which is old single column, page 601. And this starts a new block of papers. You got a pair of papers here that are a little block unto themselves before a final pair in this in part two of the book here. And obviously, it's a block on the Lucifer Rebellion, as the first paper clearly indicates. Okay, so, you know, longtime readers of the Revelation, very familiar with these two papers. I'm sure there will be lots and lots of questions and discussion and curiosity, and so should just jump it right in. Maybe just, you know, a reminder. Remember, I mentioned it at the end of the last time. You know, if it's not obvious why these papers are stuck in between, going through the planetary mortal epics, and then getting a paper on Light and Life, the Age of Light and Life, or the Era of Light and Life, is you've got a little loose end that they wanted to clear up. As we were going through those planetary mortal epics, we kept seeing over and over and over again, you know, them commenting that, well, there's what's normal and then there's you, you know, mainly because of the rebellion. Because, you know, I mean, the only reason we had a default is because of the rebellion. Adam and Eve, I'm sure, would have been fine if they'd had a solid planetary prince and his staff. You know, so it really is one problem with all kinds of ramifications. Right, so they wanted, you know, they wanted to deal with that in greater detail in the wake of them touching upon it in short over and over and over through those planetary mortal epics. All right, so and we you know, we're constantly invoking things from these papers. You know, we've been doing it pretty much constantly. You know, for years, going through the Revelation. It's just like we saw with, you know, with the previous paper. You can hardly talk about anything without it. You know, in one way or another, reminding you. Oh yeah, and of course that ties us back to the rebellion. Or oh, there is an example in the current times of an unwitting adoption of one of the principles of the Lucifer Manifesto. You know, that's a positive sign on the one hand. It means we have enough spiritual consciousness to actually do something like that. Unfortunately, we're not, you know, we're not using our objectivity potential to the point where we direct that spiritual consciousness in positive directions. We assume it's automatically in some positive direction, and that's a very poor assumption. That's the assumption that Lucifer was making initially. Right? Your spiritual consciousness is not innately divine. It's just spiritual consciousness, and it can be just as false as it can be true. And you have to choose. You have to have the objectivity to orient it one way or another, and it's a binary thing. You're either oriented true or 180 degrees. And so that brings you to, you know, to the reason why there's something somewhere in the Revelation about the Lucifer Rebellion, you know, as opposed to just why is it right after this previous paper. You know, why do they give us all this information on the Lucifer Rebellion? Is it because they know we're history buffs and, you know, we want to memorize the facts of events from 200,000 years ago? No. I mean, it's a revelation of truth, remember, not of facts. The facts are secondary to the truth. You're trying to get the truth that flows through these papers. The truths of eternity, the truths that are just as true for you and now as these individuals back then. They're trying to give us enough of the physics of spiritual consciousness so that we can be less oblivious to how easy it is to stumble into the exact same pathology that Lucifer stumbled into. Right? It's there really is only one pathology. Right? I mean, you study the way he went astray, and you're studying how every single person in the universe of universes goes astray. Right? There's only one path to perdition. Right? So by recognizing how it slipped under his radar, you can recognize how it will likewise slip under yours if you're not actively challenging yourself to not just mindlessly go along with what feels appropriate with your spiritual consciousness. You need to find the reins, and you have to definitively get a hold of them. All right, so let's get it started here.
Paper 53, The Lucifer Rebellion. Lucifer was a brilliant primary Lunanodek son of Nebadon. He had experienced service in many systems, had been a high counselor of his group, and was distinguished for wisdom, sagacity, and efficiency. Lucifer was number 37 of his order and was commissioned by the Melchizedeks. He was designated as one of the 100 most able and brilliant personalities in more than 700,000 of his kind. From such a magnificent beginning, through evil and error, he embraced sin and now is numbered as one of three system sovereigns in Nebadon who have succumbed to the urge of self and surrendered to the sophistry of spurious personal liberty, rejection of universe allegiance, and disregard of fraternal obligation, blindness to cosmic relationships.
Okay, so that's a pretty action-packed first paragraph. So let's try to get ourselves in that big frame of reference that they obviously are trying to get us started in. Stressing brilliant primary Lunanic son, and then getting even more specifics, designated one of the 100 most able and brilliant, out of the a little more than 700,000 of those primary Lunanodeks. That's an important issue. I bring that up all the time. It's very problematic if you have a lot of raw intelligence, because it's very easy for you to deceive yourself. To quickly construct a brilliant rationalization scheme that seems true. And if you're not so clever, it's much easier to end up being humble and not going astray. But it's very problematic if you've got a lot of raw smarts. All Lunanodeks do relative to us, but here he's even a cut above the norm with Lunanodeks. That's the beginning of a potential problem. But you can see that everything seemed to be going fine for a long, long time. He had experienced service in many systems. Right? So this would have been lots and lots and lots of years, and lots of systems. Right, and doing all kinds of other things that distinguished him for wisdom, sagacity, and efficiency. If you had a lot of wisdom and sagacity, wouldn't that be protection? I mean, that's what got Van through. Is that that consecration of mind? But again, you're reminded. He's very, very, very agile intellectually, right? And so even with a distinguished degree of consecration of mind, he could, get his into a tail-chasing mode around that, right? And find a way to not sort of bump into that insight and go, oops, wait a minute. It's so easy for someone that smart to fall in love with their ability to rationalize and think that they've got everything all ironed out tight. Yeah.
Of course, the Lanonics, they don't have thought adjusters either.
Right. But, you know, that's why I brought up Van. You know, Van didn't have a thought adjuster at the time that he was Integrus, right, in the face of the Planetary Rebellion. Van wasn't as smart as Lucifer, right? So, there's a relativity, right? Van had plenty of wisdom, you know, relative to his ability to deceive himself. Lucifer did not.
Right.
Yep.
So Van, did you get the names mixed up?
Van had. I don't think I did.
Had plenty of wisdom.
Van had plenty of wisdom relative to his degree of smarts, right? But Lucifer didn't. I mean, Lucifer probably had more wisdom than Van did, right? But see, again, you know, his vastly greater intellect than Van. Okay, see, so it's all relative. You know, you have to have enough of this sort of inescapable integrity in relationship to the cosmos that you can't think around it. Get yourself turned around.
I think there's a possibility that because of his brilliance, that he somewhat isolated himself or was isolated. You know how Jesus used to send the disciples out two by two so they wouldn't fall into this kind of thing?
Right. See, that's just kind of, that's a corollary of being very, very raw, you know, smart, you know, raw intelligence. You know, that you can quickly think that you don't need help from someone else. You can just handle it all yourself. You know, and in terms of just, you know, raw analytic ability or whatnot, you know, or imaginative ability, you know, you can, you know, or at least it appears, until the issue gets serious and you find your blind spot. Right? But right. So anyway, that's why they're stressing that right up front. They want you to reflect on that and recognize that fundamental issue. I've often said to myself, on the one hand, I wish I'd been had a little greater raw intellect. But then on the other hand, maybe not. There's a lot of safety in not being too smart for your own good. I'm just on my nativity sphere. I don't have to be excelling, you know, to a high degree yet. I've got enough smarts, I can look back at my life and I can see definitely that because I didn't have the kind of intellect that a lot of other people had, that I was, you know, associated with, you know, say in school, graduate school especially, I was forced to recognize my limitations and to just be more humble and not get ahead of myself. So, you know, I think when all is said and done, I'm pleased with the way it ended up. You know, that this was the hand I was dealt.
Uh-oh, you better be careful. So, on this train of thought, you know, the thing that concerns me about it is, you can't be so afraid that you're going to do something wrong you don't do something. In terms of life and living, and you know, and so on and so forth. Oftentimes, you know, we're told to, you know, like with the guy sitting up in the mountains, Jesus says, "Well, you know, you got to participate in life. You've got to do certain things." I mean, and it's almost scary in a way that, you know, when you want to make decisions and you pray about it and you try and really think you do the right thing, that, you know, if you keep second-guessing yourself all the time, I don't know if you see where I'm going with this question.
Yeah, I understand.
Right, so that's what concerns me a little bit about it. And I'm wondering if you could talk about that for a second in terms of our own personal... Mm-hmm. You know, because we are Lucifer, so to speak, and we are, you know, just beginning here and everything. And how do we know when we, you know, are trying to do the best we can that we aren't circumventing the situation?
Okay, well, there's, you know, two things. You know, step one, you know, we've touched on this many times. You're reminded again why Jesus said, before you try to do anything, work on that fear not thing. Right. When I talk about how easy it is to unwittingly slip into the same pathology that Lucifer did, that is going to be scary to your animal mind. Right? So obviously, if you're not just going to be frozen by this, you've got to have courageous and independent cosmic thinking. Right? It's very important the way they state that. I mean, you obviously need independent cosmic thinking. You need that objective perspective to notice when your subjective consciousness is going astray. But there has to be, courage there. You can't be frozen with fear to not act because it's like, well, I mean, yeah, I'm trying to be objective about it, but I probably missed something because I don't have absolute mind. And you just have to set the whole fear thing aside. You have to really work on that. Now, obviously, you can't just do that. Okay, tomorrow I don't have any fear. Okay, I'm done with that. Okay. So you can't wait until you have enough courageous, cosmic thinking, that you can act. You need to start acting. Sometimes it's forced upon you. You got to act, kind of, when you feel like you're not ready. Maybe. That's why it's so important to remember that passage up in the Jesus Papers about that which you decide on earth is honored in heaven. Right? I mean, you're not trying to do what's perfect. You're technically not even trying to do, in some absolute sense, what's always good in a finite sense of perfecting. You're striving towards that. But you're not judged upon how poorly you actually follow through with your initial thought, get it formed as an intention in the mind that directs actions. You're not judged on your intentions. Those are mindal intentions. You're judged on your motives, your spiritual motives that are behind those mindal intentions. So you may end up doing what, when all is said and done, you look back on it, it's like, well, that was really stupid. I can see it was actually evil. It actually caused great disruption of the unity, of my whole community or whatever. Okay, but you didn't have that. That wasn't your motive. That wasn't your spiritual motive. You had a positive desire, and you were trying to be as objective and clear-headed, insightful, foresightful as possible. When you took that desire and formed a spiritual motive that then led to a mindal intention, you turned out you didn't have the wisdom that you needed. So the mindal intention didn't end up being true. It ended up being false. It led to problems. Okay. But it was a good motive, even if it wasn't a true intention. And you're judged on that. And you wanted a good motive. Even if you desired a good motive, but your insight was still a bit lacking, and it ended up being a bad motive. You actually grabbed a hold of badness, but you didn't want to. Right, so there was evil there. Again, it's not sin. Right, and so they judge you relatively. Right, so you have to think about all that. So you notice that they mention evil and error there in that beginning, the contrast. They want you to start reflecting on what's the difference between evil and error. And of course, then going to sin and iniquity. There's all those details of how you're judged, but. If you have done your very best and you've made a decision and you're going with it, that which you decide on earth is honored in heaven. If you were earnest and sincere as you could be, and it's only when you're insincere, right, that there's fundamentally an issue, right? You don't get a thumbs down from the cosmos, because you aren't infinitely wise, right? If it was damning to not be infinitely wise, all the Melchizedeks would be frozen in place too, and none of them would dare act, right? Because they know they can occasionally do something that's not wise. So you want to try to definitely get control of your fear, but what little is there, remind yourself, it's okay, right? And as long as you're not insincere, you know, don't be afraid. To the degree that you still can be, that which you decide on earth is honored in heaven if you did your very best, right? And it's fundamentally because, you know, why is it honored in heaven? Because the only kind of things that we're talking about are finite facts. And the supreme mind can work with any set of finite facts. You don't have to get all frozen. It's like, well, what if I do something that just brings the whole universe to a halt? I mean, you know, you can't do that, right? The supreme mind can work with any set of finite facts. It can take anything you do to goodness, right? So, see, what little fear you can't get over innately, you ought to be able to just let go because of that, knowing that, the Supreme can handle it, okay? You know, we don't have to be perfect. Yeah?
Is it spiritual motive?
Mm-hmm.
Where does that come from?
I was touching upon some of the physics that they get into about how our minds work, how that's related to how deity works. It's fundamentally remembering that unlike an animal, you don't just have mind and matter in play. You have three aspects to what you're up to: spirit, mind, and matter. And humans have never known the meanings of the words intention and motive. What I'm talking about, you can't look up in the dictionary. Right? It's revealed to us in the fifth epical revelations. None of those things are clarifications where they get you to recognize that there's a distinction between a motive and an intention. We're constantly misusing that intention. It's like, well, I had good intentions. That's actually a misuse of the word. It's good or bad motives. It's true or false intentions. And you can genuinely have a good motive, but through a lack of wisdom, when that goes through your mind activity, that motive goes from the spiritual to the mindal, gets expressed as an intention, it can be false. Right, so there's an example where, I mean, it's a good motive, so there's not evil in play, but you still end up with error because of lack of wisdom. So that's a mere error. That's like what Melchizedek's can do. But we can take it another notch. Because of your lack of insight, lack of cosmic discrimination, something may appear to be good to you, but it's really bad. Right? So you take a hold of it, thinking it's good, but it's actually bad. Right? You made a wrong choice, but it wasn't purposeful. Right? You didn't consciously go, "Oh, here's bad." With some goofy notion, but literally, objectively, you can distinguish objective good from bad, and you pick that which you objectively recognize as bad because it's bad. Okay, that's sin. That's a different matter. If it's just, well, it looks good to me, down the road, you reflect back on it, and you discover, oh, okay, now I see it actually wasn't. But it appeared to be good, and that's why you took a hold of it. Okay, if it actually was bad, that's just evil. Right? But see, that spiritual motive gets formed into a mindal intention. And
they say the mistakes you don't forget in time, you will forget in eternity. So
right, there's those sorts of things. And it's just, remember, the thing that always trips people up, I mean, even if you were to, apply the words properly like I'm doing here, people always assume that if you have a good motive, that leads to a true intention. Right? that's not true. Because there's two different consecrations involved. The consecration of your will to the perfect will of God the Father may definitively get you a good motive, but it doesn't guarantee a true intention. That's the other consecration, consecration of your mind to the universal harmony of God the Mother. It's only this, the surety of that consecration that in, you know, that makes sure that that good motive gets expressed as a true intention. And it's the intention that actually, you know, with mind over matter, is going to lead to what you're going to do with your body, your mouth, your, you know, your hands, your feet, your whatnot, you know, and actually putting it into action in the material world. You know, that's dictated by the intention. So it doesn't matter if there's a good motive. Your hands don't follow the good motive. Your hands follow the intention. And if it's a false intention, your hands move falsely. You haven't properly taken into account all the details of the specifics of time and space and matter and individuality to get that good motive formed into a true intention. A true intention, an intention that embodies the wholeness of things. You've got some part-wise notion, and so your intention doesn't end up being true. It's a false intention. And if you are, if you're courageous in assessing your actions, you can look back on that and notice, like, oh, I was getting a negative feedback as I was putting that into practice. You know, the experience was trying to tell me that my intention was false. Right? Yeah, you were experiencing some upstream, right? You know, in your actions. You know, and instead of dismissing that, or saying, "Oh, that's because there's this conspiracy aligned against me, or something," right? You know, you should have noticed that, you know, and thought, oh, you know, maybe I need to pause here. Instead of getting a bigger hammer out, maybe I need to take a breather, go back and try to assess this again. Maybe I'm not doing this properly. Okay, all right. Like I said, there's an awful lot when you start talking about this.
Sorry.
No, but that's, you know, I mean, I'm expecting this because, and it's important. I mean, I don't want you, obviously we don't want to just read one paragraph in 2 hours, but some of these issues, it's high time that mankind got this stuff sorted out. Mankind has never understood any of this. The best minds on the planet have never understood these things. You know, they're going to tell us that at the beginning of the next paper. It's very important that we get this stuff straightened out, because like I said, I mean, the automatic assumption of someone that has spiritual consciousness is nothing can go wrong if you have good intention. You know, if you have so-called good intentions, you know, actually good motives, right? In other words, the intentions are automatically true. Right? That's if you think about why there's an emergency on the planet, that's basically why, because people are not appreciating that even though they have this very positive vision in their mind, right, they don't have the wisdom to implement it in a true fashion, and so you get the exact opposite of what you were hoping for. All right, let's see. Now back to the other stuff that's in here. Okay, remember how we mentioned a while back, it's kind of fun, that fun little numerical coincidence, apparently, that he's number 37 in the Lenin Index, and there's 37 spheres that join the rebellion. So it's easier to remember it, too, because they're the same number. But the thing about that is, you know, he's a very, see, very low number. Right? He's one of the very first Lindonidex. Let's see. What else do we have there? Notice the past tense, right from the beginning. Lucifer was a brilliant primary Lindonidex. You know, We've wondered about this some. I mean, more so than with Caligastia, apparently. You know, especially post-Pentecost, where he was, you know, why he was actually interned in the prison world, and no one goes to visit him, you know, and all this sort of stuff. He's not a sophistry anymore. If you approach him now, you know, it isn't this brilliant white spiritual candy on the outside that deceives you into thinking, you know, it's white all the way to the core. He was a brilliant, right? So, you know, his inner darkness is on the outside now, and recognizable even to those with very shallow insight, okay? So just notice all that past tense that they've got here. Through evil and error, it starts out, he's ignorant what's going on, but eventually it reaches the point where he recognizes, oops, okay? But he continued on, you know, he embraced sin and has gone, you know, technically to iniquity. Okay, and then some of the physics is very important. That goes beyond the history. Succumb to the urge of self and surrender to the sophistry of spurious personal liberty. And remember how the next paper starts with true and false liberty. Right? Liberty is a very powerful spirit word. Right? Burns in anyone with any spiritual consciousness. Very dangerous thought, right? In the hands of the unwise, the ignorant. Very easy to get astray on with liberty. See, why? Because it's just innately produces a sophistry, like I was just describing. It's a delight just to say the word, right? I mean, just to hold the word in your mind, you know, you feel the delight of it. It just sort of wraps itself in spiritual candy automatically. And you just shut down. You it's like, this is too good to, to look at carefully. Anything that feels this wonderful, I've got to just run with it.
Liberty or give me death.
Yes, right. You know, see, the passion is instantly there, right? You're willing to die for liberty almost, you know, the moment you put the word in your mind. It's a very powerful spiritual word, okay? And so, not surprisingly, something that powerful in ignorant hands can take you, or it took Lucifer. But what's the spurious thing? See, the parenthetical with the M dash there, you know, I try to explain it. Okay, so first they say rejection of universal allegiance and disregard of fraternal obligations. And then they sum it up as blindness to cosmic relationships. They keep coming back to that pair. Recognition of personal responsibility and the exercise of self-control. Right? Which only comes with cosmic consciousness. Recognition there, you know, this rejection of universe allegiance. You know, you have a personal responsibility. Disregard for fraternal obligations. You know, you must control yourself. Yourself is not something that controls itself properly, right? The whole point of your existence is to give you something that has no innate divinity. You have to impose control on it. Self-mastery is the only thing that you're up to. That's the whole point. Is taking that unmastered self and mastering it. And the worst thing you can do is thinking that it doesn't need to be mastered, that it doesn't need to be controlled. Well, it has spiritual consciousness, so it's innately divine. I don't need to control it. I should just, you know, take the bridle off and let her run, right? That's what most people think. That's what Lucifer thought. And you don't want to go where that unbridled spiritual consciousness takes you. you know, material consciousness is arithmetic. You'll get physically exhausted before you get anywhere down a path towards iniquity with something as arithmetic as your material consciousness. But spiritual consciousness is geometric. Right? You will go far down that road before you know what's happened to you. Yeah? Before Lucifer had any awareness of, oops, he was way down the road. Right? It happens very fast. So that's, you know, see, they're giving you all those details right up front. You know, they're just by what words they choose to say, they're trying to get you to have kind of this very complex reflective picture, all embodied in the first paragraph. All right, let's see. Oh, you got something on the webinar?
David's been waiting. Mm-hmm. What would cause the smarts that Lucifer had? After all, he had no genetic complement. Why would one on that level be smarter than others on that same level? What could be responsible for the difference?
I mean, you know, basically, it's just a vastness of mind, you know, that he's, you know, when you go up higher and higher beings, they just have bigger and bigger minds. You know, we've talked about things, you know, like the divine counselor is given the assignment. He goes, okay, so let me just consciousize everything that humans have written. Right, I mean, these beings have vast minds. Right, you know, he's not sticking it in, you know, background memory, you know, cells or something. No, he's putting it all in active, upfront consciousness. You know, and it's a trivial thing to do. Right, these beings have vast minds. A Lananadec, you know, yeah, it's not as high as a divine counselor or even an archangel or something, but, you know, relative to us.
We don't use all of them.
Right, I mean, you're basically kind of getting up to a primary Lananadec level to some degree, right when you're a Gerasim citizen.
Really?
Right, I mean, you're getting kind of up to his level, right, you know, in certain ways. But you know, think about what they say. You know, we've just been reading here recently. I mean, your mind has so much more capacity, is so much vaster, even on the first mansion world, that you can't even really imagine thought there. Right. So take that way past the first mansion world, all the way to Gerasim citizenship. I mean, what kind of an incredible vast mind are you going to have? All right, so, yeah, but of course you're still nothing compared to a divine counselor or something, right? But
did Van have that mind when he came here, or did he not bring that with him?
He does. He just doesn't have kind of the catalyzer of that, of his adjuster, right? That's one of the reasons I was just going to mention that. No, I mean, that one of the reasons you can kind of be sort of getting a little bit on a par with a Lananadec as a Gerasim citizen is because you have that adjuster to kind of juice you up, you know. Anyway, you know, they just, you know, they have this very vast mind, and it works very fluidly, very holistically. I mean, you know, you just... You know, we can't even imagine how easy it would be for a Lananadec to demagogue you. Right? If you were standing there on Gerasim, listening to his silver tongue, I mean, you would be so hook, line, and sinker. Right? Remember, I mean, you know, he played seraphim like, you know, cheap puppets. Right? I mean, it was nothing for him to just get them completely mesmerized. Like, oh, wow, that is so incredibly, you know, he can wrap spiritual candy around something, right, like you can't imagine. I mean, you would be so lost so quickly, right? I mean, remember, that was the whole deal with Mount Hermon and Jesus, right? The question was, can I engage them directly as a human? Now, he's a first circler, right? When he engaged Satan and Caligastia there on Mount Hermon, and he could handle it, right? But, you know, one of us, I mean, they would have us so wrapped around the axle so fast, right? You wouldn't know what happened to you, right? There's no way you could maintain your objectivity. You just get sucked into their, you know, their rationalization scheme so fast.
So wonderful that 99.999% of them are like that.
Yeah, that take that brilliance,
yeah,
and flip it 180 degrees like that and use it against beings. Yeah. You know, otherwise, I mean, you wouldn't have any seraphim left in short order. Right? The seraphim would just, the Lindonodex would lay waste to the seraphim in short order.
It would also, yeah, also put Michael in the category of an incompetent creator.
Yeah.
I mean, if you had that many individuals making that choice,
yeah,
then you would wonder at just giving them any kind of liberty whatsoever. Mm-hmm. But only 700 of even the minor Monadex have gone down, and that's out of 12 million. So it's a tiny, yeah, tiny, tiny fraction.
Yeah. But, of course, you know, if you're functioning as a system sovereign, you have a lot of people that are following your every word. So, you know, huge ramifications.
So it'll be refreshing, yeah, to hear Lana Forge, who,
yeah,
never was tempted even in front of his superior, yeah, and to know we've got a faithful father, our, yeah, third father.
Our third father, yeah.
Will be a wonderful, wonderful, faithful father.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, but, you know, like we talked about when we were back there reading about the Mansion Worlds, you know, how many instances of, you know, when you're working through the Mansion Worlds, the system sovereign or his assistant, you know, are working with you directly, and, you know that you have to be able to, you know, to handle that. You know, that those individuals, you know, that were there 200,000 years ago, you know, it's not like someone jumped in and, you know, and said, okay, now don't listen to what Satan is saying here, you know, in this wonderful class he's conducting with you ascenders, right? I mean, those ascenders just, you know, had to find the integrity to not get sucked into that. And you can imagine a lot of them failed the test, right? You know, like we talked about on the first two Mansion Worlds, you know, you can be certain that there was a lot of those who didn't make it. A lot of ascenders that were lost. Okay. Anyway, let's see if we can get back here to it. All right, so what's that other paragraph there in the preface?
Still more over here, though.
Uh-oh.
Okay. Just a final clarification. David is asking, why would Lananadex differ from one another in mind capacity and capability?
We talked about that back when we were talking about the Lananadex. Right, the more you downstep these local universe suns, they're going, you're getting closer and closer to individuality. You're starting at unity down through associativity to individuality. So as you express them downward, they fan outward. And, you know, there's all these different flavors of Lananadex, all this variation, because they're more individually expressed. You know, so there's this greater mindal distinctiveness. I mean, obviously every personality is absolutely unique, but, you know, that's not the spirit of the question that's being asked there. The fundamental, you know, why are they mindally so fun? You know, their mindal selves, why are they so different? And it's just because when you express down like that, those Lananadex need to be attuned to all kinds of diversity. Right, and so they're naturally expressed in great diversity like that.
So, okay. In the universe of Nebadon, the domain of Christ Michael, There are 10,000 systems of inhabited worlds. In all the history of Onondaga's sons, in all their work throughout these thousands of systems, and at the universe headquarters, only three system sovereigns have ever been found in contempt of the government of the Creator Son.
Okay, so that's, you know, just a pretty basic, straightforward statement. Reminding you what a lot of you remember, that there's just been three system rebellions. But again, like was kind of between the lines here in the conversation a minute ago, you know, you can easily imagine that there are some local universes that wouldn't have any, you know, system rebellions because, you know, their Creator Son runs a much tighter ship.
Could there have been planetary rebellions without system rebellions?
Yes, and that's, you know, there's been, you know, lots of planetary rebellions independent of the system rebellions, yes. I mean, obviously there's a bunch of planetary rebellions within a system rebellion, but, you know, just a pure planetary rebellion with an Integris system sovereign, you know, that has happened too, yeah. Yeah, and then you'd have, you know, problems on that planet probably with the Adam and Eve. Right.
The leaders of rebellion. Lucifer was not an ascended being. He was a created son of the local universe, and of him it was said, "You were perfect in all your ways from the day you were created till unrighteousness was found in you." Many times had he been in council with the Most Highs of Edentia, and Lucifer reigned upon the holy mountain of God, the administrative mount of Jerusalem, for he was the chief executive of a great system of 607 inhabited worlds.
Okay, yeah, so remember that at the time of the rebellion, there were only 607 inhabited worlds. 12 have become inhabited since the rebellion. And these two quotes, okay, they're going to do this several times here in this first section. They're quoting from the Bible, and it's a great example of, again, for you to recognize, you know, how quotes are used in the Revelation. Remember, it's a revelation of truth. The point is not to just disclose facts. It's certainly, you know, the point of this book is not to just quote, factually quote the Bible. What would be the point? Right? They're never quoting the Bible factually. Now, even if the quote ends up being, it's like, oh, that's actually word for word out of the King James Version or whatever. That's not the point. Right? They're always quoting the truth that might be in the Bible. And here are some simple examples. So here you've got both of those quotes are being taken from Ezekiel. And, you know, Ezekiel is a prophet. He was reading the Riot Act to the king of Tyre, okay, in this particular instance. Okay, so factually, Ezekiel is talking to the king of Tyre and making these statements. So when it says, of him, Lucifer, it was said, you're going, oh, well, I found that whoever wrote this book doesn't even, you know, they can't even read the Bible, and, you know, and they don't even know that this sentence is about the king of Tyre. It's not about Lucifer. Okay, what's the error you've made there? Right? Thinking that they're interested in the Bible factually. No. Right, what they're pointing out is, yeah, factually, that's about the king of Tyre. Okay, but they're pointing out to you, especially if they just, you know, tweak a few words occasionally, you know, in these quote-unquote quotations, you can recognize that there's a truth flowing through that sentence that's appropriate to Lucifer in this case. Right? Even though Ezekiel was saying it of the king of Tyre, in fact, they're pointing out, in truth, and he was saying it of Lucifer. Right, those statements are true of Lucifer. You were perfect in all your ways. I mean, you're thinking, yeah, I'll bet the king of Tyre wasn't perfect. You know, and they tweak little things like throwing in the all, you know, you're perfect in all your ways, you know. You know, so they will tweak the facts of a sentence, you know, so that it matches how they're using it. But the whole point is the truth that's flowing through it, not the fact, right? You know, and a lot of times they'll say, you know, technically that isn't really a very valid thing in the Bible in and of itself, but I can pull it out of there and I can use that string of words in a different context and have it be a means for expressing truth. You've got to think like that. If you're just merely a fact finder, you're not going to get anywhere with the revelation. You're just going to trip over it endlessly, you know, unless you read it with your eyes closed. The moment you open your eyes, you're going to stumble over everything in it. And you'll decide it's just a total fraud and you're going to throw it away. Right? So quotations are never a fact. They're quoting truth. All right, so, pointing out things like, you know, not some mountain in Palestine, right, that's gotten exalted by those people, right? They're reminding you, there's a truth to that. If you apply it to Lucifer, right, there's the mound on Gerizim, the administrative mount. Right? So they're just, you know, they're pointing out that you can take those things and you can apply them. Now, remember, they were told, rather than them constructing the string of words similar to that, if they can find a string of words that humans have put together, they're supposed to use that, right? And that may mean they pull it out of context where it was about the king of Tyre and they make it about Lucifer. Right? You got to think that way with the revelation. All right. Besides the quotes, was there anything out there that, let's see.
Well, I had a question.
Yeah, you got a question in that?
So when you look at the 607 inhabited worlds, yeah, that at that particular time, can you somehow extrapolate from that, you know, how many worlds are being, you know, inhabited in a period of time? Because this was, we were 606, that was like, what, 250,000 years ago, or approximately when the thing went.
Well, remember, 200,000, you know, in the last 200,000 years, there's been 12.
Since,
okay. Yeah, see, so that gives you a little bit of a...
So there was one after us that would happen to be...
Right. So, I mean, who knows? Maybe it's the neighboring planet that they write about in here, right? I mean, it's so close to us evolutionarily. Maybe it's 607 of Zaytania. But, you know, the neighboring planet, you know, up there in the civilization papers. The quote-unquote neighboring planet up there in the civilization papers. But remember, you know, we read a little bit ago, they apparently come in blocks of 200, right? You know, so we're the third block of 200. We don't quite know. I mean, it's spread apart by a long ways. I mean, you know, it's at least hundreds of millions of years apart.
It takes a while to get started.
Right, you know, so, yeah.
Okay. Lucifer was a magnificent being, a brilliant personality. Here we go, was. He stood next to the Most High Fathers of the constellations in the direct line of universe authority. Notwithstanding Lucifer's transgression, subordinate intelligences refrained from showing him disrespect and disdain prior to Michael's bestowal on Urantia. Even the archangel of Michael, at the time of Moses' resurrection, did not bring against him an accusing judgment, but simply said, "The judge rebuke you." Judgment in such matters belongs to the Ancients of Days, the rulers of the super universe.
Okay, so they're giving you that basic bit about, how much respect, celestial beings have for them, even, right, when, all right, I mean, he's gone into rebellion, he's been replaced by Lanaforge, right, and the whole nine yards, right, and that's gone on for 200,000 years until he's finally, you know, thrown in prison. If they show him that much respect, even when it's clear, because he's been deposed, that he's gone into rebellion, again, think about how much respect they have innately, you know, before they knew he was going into rebellion, right? How many would just, you know, lemming over the cliff with him, right? I mean, you know, they basically, you know, and when you don't have a thought adjuster, like say none of the seraphim do, you don't have a lot of ability to think above the Nonadek. You're kind of just stuck, you know, you sort of just blindly follow him over the cliff if he goes over the cliff, right?
But every last one of them didn't.
Yeah, no. But it's just, it's going to, you know that the casualties are going to be very high, see, because of this. And see, so that's what's between the lines, you know. Of, it's like, oh my goodness, if they're showing him that much respect, you know, then how much, you know, how many of them just would have nodded their head no matter what he said, right?
I could remind you of something going on today in our country.
Right, again, so you've got to recognize that. It's very easy for a politician to feed you some spiritual candy and for you to nod your head up and down and turn off your critical thinking, right? Your first instinct will be, oh, well, they said something spiritual there, so I don't even need to, you know, to have any critical thinking. I can just follow everything they're saying. I mean, every sentence out of Lucifer's mouth was spiritual. It's a spirit being, right? The tricky, you know, individuals are not those, you know, that, you know, some very prosaic politician, you know, that never tweaks your spiritual consciousness. You don't have to worry about them, right? The ones you got to worry about are the ones that have enough spiritual consciousness that they get they tweak, you know, your attention. You go, ooh, he said something that makes me feel spiritual inside. Okay, turn off brain, follow him. Right? Or her. Right? That's what we do. Right? You know, someone with some spiritual consciousness that can wield it like that is a Pied Piper.
Okay. That's... Isaac probably did that a little bit when he was here. They didn't try to put him down or anything.
Jesus, right, did it without even trying. Right? I mean, if he had any deceit... Right. How many people could he have led astray? Right. Everyone was putty in his hands. Right.
Well, it's not entirely true.
You know?
I wouldn't say the people that put him to death were putty in his hands.
No.
He could have exercised.
If he had been deceitful, if he had done the Lucifer thing, right, with his silver tongue talents. I mean, just his bearing, just the way he could have so easily, right, manipulated people.
Which makes you think a magisterial son probably has a lot of influence. Right.
When they get here, right. It's very important. You know, they all know how much influence they have. You know, I mean, you know, think about how impressive it is. You show up, you know, in corporeal form with 12 corporeal Melchizedeks. I mean, everyone just immediately falls down and wants to worship you, right? I mean, you know, all you had to be was 8 foot tall and, you know, and a blob of protoplasm, and everyone wanted to worship Adam and Eve. And of course, when they found they glowed in the dark, well, that sealed the deal, right? I mean, we're pretty easy to manipulate, right? You got to recognize this, you know, that these people know what kind of incredible trust is put in their hands. I mean, that's why it's so horrendous, you know, what Caligastia or Satan or Lucifer did. I mean, the violation of trust is huge, right? Because they know that most people can't resist them.
You know, you bring up something so important there. It's never occurred to me before until you've been talking that way, that's part of what we can't imagine about a normal world.
Yeah.
Because these guys have not an ounce of wanting to do that to us.
Right.
By the time a magisterial son is coming to bestow himself in that age, a normal world, they're completely disabused of any of those notions. They really are beginning to see truth for truth.
And
they're not going to be wowed by
somebody
that doesn't have the real truth.
Yeah.
The magisterial son has no interest whatsoever in even coming until until it's a natural thing, that it's not going to be a coercive thing at all.
Yeah, exactly. And like I said, you remember when we went through those Entre Mortal Epics, you know, the startling thing that we discovered is they're trying to explain to us how you can't even really imagine the post-planetary prince age, you know, especially if you and then throw in the post-Adamic age on a normal world. I mean, you've eliminated all fear, you know, and all this sort of stuff. I mean, to try to imagine a world, you know, the magisterial son comes to this world and no one is afraid.
You have civilization.
Yeah, you know, there's this, you know, you have full ultimatonic level physics, you know, and everything, you know. I mean, there's no degeneracy, there's no, you know, there's no defective, antisocial, any, you know. I mean, it's just completely beyond our imagination to have a populace that's that integrous. Yeah, and like you're saying, when they're that integrous, you know, they won't fall for foolishness. Yeah. All right, but anyway, yeah. So just to you know, to appreciate this. Okay, so
here's some more quotes too.
Yeah, yeah. So I was going to get to that. Let's see. Maybe I was just to make sure there wasn't anything else there. Let's see. Respect. Okay, and then the quote thing. So you're quoting from Jude there, right? You know, the book right before the book of Revelation, you know, sitting next to the last book in the Bible. You know, it's about the assumption of Moses. And, you know, that's why Jude is there at the end, you know, because it's quoting, you know, a non-canonical work. You know, it's one of those last books in the Bible that Martin Luther thought, you know, we probably should just take these out of the Bible. But he finally decided he couldn't do that, but he put them at the end. You know, so all those ones at the end. You know, there's various issues. That the common people might, you know, stumble over. You know, but anyway, you're quoting from Jude. And, you know, here again. You know, they freely tweak as they want to, so that they can use it in truth. You know, when it says the judge rebuke you here, as you might guess, it doesn't say that in the Bible. And it says, you know, the Lord rebuke you. Right? What have they done? They put in capital J judge because they want to use it for the Ancients of Days. Right? You know, and of course, you know, it says Michael the Archangel, not the Archangel of Michael, right? All right, as we all know. Right, so they're just, you know, they're taking that and they're tweaking it.
It does say the Archangel.
Yeah, here it says the Archangel of Michael, but in the Bible it's
okay, right.
It's Michael the Archangel.
Right.
All right. All right, so again, you know, that one is, you know, is basically in context. They're just tweaking it a little bit, unlike the, you know, the one out of Ezekiel. All right, and remember, we read about that whole issue that there was you have the normal dispensational resurrections, but you know, the whole issue of millennial resurrections and special. You know, special resurrections like Moses is, you know, were very important because prior to Pentecost, even if you were a first circler when you died, you couldn't ascend as an individual, right? You know, so remember when we talked about that, Moses and another group were especially brought up to the mansion worlds because they wanted them ahead of even the next millennial resurrection. Yeah, there's something on the webinar?
Yeah, John Stevens would like to know if Lucifer was in his spirit mind. Was he thinking in the upper domain of the hourglass? Does that analogy pertain to the non-deities?
Every being you can think of it has in an hourglass analogy. I mean, obviously, a Lenanadec doesn't have adjutant mind in the lower domain of the hourglass. They have the appropriate local universe type mind, encirclement. But then that mindal self is encircuited in the Holy Spirit, which gives them an upper domain in the hourglass analogy, right? And you know, he's chugging along with his very brilliant mind out in the lower domain, and everything seems groovy to him. You know, and then one day, right, the cosmic intuitions that he has, because he has an upper domain and he can objectively look down on that self and go, oh, wait a minute, that's not correct. Right? Right? He has to have an encirclement of the Holy Spirit. He has to have an upper domain, and there's no way that you have a... You're a self-aware self. The upper domain makes you a self-aware self so that you can notice, oh, self has problem, right? If you're not a self-aware self, you're just going to, you know, mindlessly, quote, you know, blindly go on, right? Right. So, yes, he's got an upper domain, the encirclement in the Holy Spirit. You know, and at that point, when he recognized through that insight that he had gone astray, he didn't have the courage to turn around. Right, so he became insincere at that point. Right? He started consciously choosing that which he knew to be wrong. Okay. So you know, they never miss an opportunity. You know, instead of blurring everything into Lord, you know, like the Bible does. Like, you know, sometimes they're going, well, you know, in truth, you know, you don't want to think of the Universal Father there. You want to think of the Ancients of Days there, because they're the capital J judges. All right.
Lucifer is now the fallen and deposed sovereign of Satania. Self-contemplation is most disastrous, even to the exalted personalities of the celestial world. Of Lucifer it was said, "Your heart was lifted up because of your beauty. You corrupted your wisdom because of your brightness." Your olden prophet saw his sad estate when he wrote, "How are you fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning? How are you cast down, you who dared to confuse the worlds?"
Okay, so let's take it one step at a time here. Bunch of stuff there. Okay, so the first thing, he's now fallen and deposed, yes. Then they give you some physics again. It's very relevant to you. Self-contemplation is most disastrous. So giving you a little reminder, don't get into that, you know, into a mode that's too introspective.
Navel gazing,
right? Yeah, too introspective, problematic. And they're trying to explain to you, it's like, well, fundamentally, why is it problematic? Because, okay, the hourglass analogy I was talking about is right here. You've got this upper domain of your mindal self and the hourglass analogy of your mindal self. The temple within. The whole point of getting up there in the upper domain is to have this self-disinterested, objective, top-down ability to look down on the mindal self and assess it. You know, you're supposed to be in communion with the cosmos in that upper domain. But if you drag yourself up into the upper domain, and so as delightful as communing with the cosmos can feel, genuine worship in the upper domain, so will it feel to commune with yourself in the upper domain. Your self will masquerade as the glory of the cosmos. If you drag it up into the upper domain, you'll fall in love with yourself, like Lucifer did. Right? Self-contemplation. The self with the temple. Most disastrous.
Different than self-mastery.
Right. Self-mastery is when you keep the self down there, and from above you reach down and take a hold of its reins and control it. Right? But if you falsely exalt it, if you lift it up, right, you know, that's self-righteousness. Right? Instead of that upper domain being in conformity with the cosmos, righteousness. Right. That upper domain will be in conformity with the self that's up there, self-righteousness, right? The self will masquerade as the whole, as the cosmos. It will be the definition of wholeness, the definition of truth. Right? The self becomes everything. The Alpha and the Omega, right? The whole and the part. It's most disastrous. You just take it literally. Contemplation is a very properly constructed word. There's an upper domain. There's a temple within. Okay? And the con means with, right? You don't want the self up there with the temple. The self is to stay down in the lower domain.
Subjective.
Right? The subjective self. Don't exalt it into the objective. And it happens very unwittingly. And initially when you tell people the words subjective and objective, they go, oh, my consciousness is objective and your consciousness is subjective. Right? It seems foolish and innocent enough, but you've begun the process. Right? You have an upper domain by grace. It doesn't matter if you know nothing about this physics, if you know nothing about thinking about yourself precisely in the hourglass analogy, it's there. And you will begin to falsely exalt yourself. Right? You won't have healthy self-regard culminated by self-respect. You'll take the self up too high. You'll take it up another notch to self-esteem. Or worse yet, you'll take it all the way up to the sixth level of meaning, self-admiration, self-love. The self, you lift the self up just to that initial level of self-respect on the fourth level of meaning so that you have an objective perspective, right? But no higher. If you take it up any higher, all good things taken to extreme become bad. You know, and those are the levels, 3, 4, 5, 6, self-regard, self-respect, self-esteem, self-contemplation. And all the self-esteem movement. You know, everyone thinks self-esteem is a positive word. That's the beginning of the rebellion in every one of those people. It's like, well, they're not. They have no desire to join the rebellion. They have nothing but positive desires. Yeah, Lucifer didn't either. He wanted the era of light and life. That's what he desired. The full glory of the era of light and life. That was his desire. What did he get? The orgy of darkness and death. everyone thinks that Lucifer desired the orgy of darkness and death. That's why he's so evil. No. No. He desired the era of light and life, just like everyone on the planet that has spiritual consciousness does. It begins very innocently. Yeah, he took the self up one notch too high to begin with, and he started to have self-esteem. He started to follow the self-esteem movement. One of the initial participants in the self-esteem movement. Okay.
Even Jesus talked about it. Building men's self-respect.
Right. If this doesn't ring a bell for you, go search these things in the Jesus papers. Right. Who had problems of taking self-respect up one notch too high to self-esteem? The apostle whom Jesus loved. You feel the tension with that? It's like, John, you've taken the self up one notch too high, right? I mean, they directly talk about he had self-esteem, right, which is the beginnings of a negative thing. Right? He didn't take it up to the sixth level of meaning where it was self-admiration, self-love. Right?
Came from getting carried around.
But it's the beginning of a problem. Really, John? The apostle whom Jesus loved? Come on, are you listening to yourself there? You can see all that up there. Jesus taught self-respect, not self-esteem, and certainly not self-love. Right? But you've got all kinds of people with spiritual consciousness that tell everyone, you should love yourself. Oh my God, no. That's the beginning of the end. If you succeed in that, it will be most disastrous. Right? Right. You know, and you go, well, wait a minute. Well, I'm supposed to love my neighbor as I love myself, aren't I? Well, yeah, so you can misinterpret that. And I've got to remember, there's a Q&A on the website about this very thing. You have to properly understand that. Okay, and then Jesus explains that. That quote-unquote love there is not sixth level of meaning love. It's fourth level of meaning love. It's quote-unquote brotherly love. It's not actually love, it's kindness. Right? If you take that above the fourth level where it's appropriate, and if you drag that up ignorantly to the sixth level, this genuine love instead of kindness, it becomes the antithesis of a positive. It becomes most disastrous. Right? And again, to just recognize that these words matter, because even though none of us have achieved very high relationships to these higher levels of meaning, they're there by grace. And you don't have to be doing this stuff consciously. Right? Lucifer's descent began completely unconsciously. He was making unconscious decisions and unconscious choices initially. That's why you have to be very sober about this. Thinking, well, there's nothing in my conscious mind that's a problem. Well, and you're assuming that your consciousness is your whole mind. I mean, it's most of your mind is unconscious. And it's full of activity. It can make choices because there's a personality identified with it by grace. You can make unconscious choices. You can unconsciously alter your relationship to eternity. That should get your attention. I mean, have you ever noticed you're reading along in the book and they say, unconscious choice? You go, what? An unconscious choice? Right. Humans have never thought you could do that.
It doesn't say trust everything beyond the dead level.
Yeah. All right, anyway, we could, yeah, that's a whole conversation. But anyway.
There's more quotes here.
Yeah, yes. Let's get back to this. I just want, I'm belaboring some of these physics things because I want you to recognize what they're trying to tell us there, why this is so useful to us. Okay, and then they go, of Lucifer it was said, quote, your heart was lifted up because of your beauty, you corrupted your wisdom because of your brightness. You go, well, that kind of sounds like those other quotes. Yeah, it's in the same passage in Ezekiel, as the bit, you were perfect in all your ways, Yeah, so again, it's talking about the king of Tyre. But it says, of Lucifer it was said. It wasn't said of Lucifer in fact. It was said of Lucifer in truth. Right? The revelators are taking that. It's like, well, in truth, that applies to Lucifer. Even though Ezekiel was not talking to Lucifer. Okay? He wasn't even thinking about Lucifer. Okay. The Melchizedek receivers were working with prophets trying to deal with all the king problems and all this sort of stuff that was going on the planet. Okay, so they're doing the exact same thing they did up there with Ezekiel. And then your olden prophet, that's Isaiah. Okay, and this is first Isaiah. And, if you have a King James Bible, right, you actually basically have this, these statements in there. You've got the word Lucifer, right, in there. A more recent translation doesn't have Lucifer in there. It'll say morning star. Okay, oh, morning star, son of the dawn. For instance, it might say. Okay, because we've talked about this before. So here, but let's do it again. This is this is the actual spot where they're giving us. So let's go through this whole thing and let's try to get this square. The system sovereign's name is not Latin. Okay, even 200,000 years ago. Yeah, right. The system sovereign doesn't have a name that's a Latin name, Lucifer. Right? Lucifer is a name that we have, that they've adopted to use for the system sovereign. right? I mean, the actual system sovereign's name is something in the local universe tongue, right?
Just like Michael's name.
Right, it's not Michael. Again, it's not Hebrew. right. The Isle of Paradise, you know, creators of creator sons don't name their kids Hebrew names. Right, they're using this, they're using the Latin name Lucifer. Okay, what is Lucifer actually referring to in Latin mythology? It's actually a capital L, right, in Latin mythology. It's the name for Venus, right, when it's the morning star. When, you know, Venus is in front of the sun before the sun rises. Right? You know, so it's the bright and morning star, quote unquote, right? Lucifer just is referring to Venus as the morning star. You know, so that's why you can translate it more literally as, you know, O morning star, right? Son of the dawn. Okay. And that's the way it's being used. There, Isaiah is invoking that heavenly deity, Venus in the morning, right? he's doing the same thing Ezekiel is doing. He's reading the riot act to a king, the king of Babylon. Right? So this is in the midst of a great big long passage. It's talking about the king of Babylon. It has nothing to do with Lucifer. It has nothing to do with the system sovereign. It has to do with the king of Babylon. Right? So, but you've got the statement, your olden prophet saw his sad estate when he wrote. Okay. Again, in truth. And the fact that but do you notice they took it a little bit further? And say saw. So referring to an actual vision that Isaiah probably had, right? You know, and they may be trying to tell you there that the words that Isaiah used against the king of Babylon might have had some basis in some visions that he had that actually were tied to Gerizim. You know, he had no conscious recognition of such things, like they always tell you. I mean, they're always, you know, John had visions and he's blurring Salvington and Gerizim together. You know, it's all a muddle, right? But the fact that they say saw his sad estate, maybe that's indicating that Isaiah was actually taking his inspiration from that vision in terms of how he was wagging his finger at the king of Babylon, right? Oh, how you have fallen from heaven, right? You remember the king of Babylon is thought of as basically a deity and everything, you know. I mean, so, you know, and everyone had, you know, everyone had some name for Venus in the morning and Venus in the evening. They didn't know it was Venus, right? You know, they didn't know it was a planet, and they didn't even know it was the same thing. You know, they thought that it was two different gods, the god that was preceding the sun in the morning and the god that was following the sun in the evening, right? And so, you know, in Latin, it was Lucifer for the morning. What was it for Venus as the evening star?
Satan.
Think of prayers.
Vesper.
Right. 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 Vesper. Not Vespers. That's the prayers. But Vesper. Right. Vesper is the name for Venus in the evening in Latin. You know, and every, you know, the Babylonians, they had their name, you know, they had a name for Venus in the morning and Venus in the evening. You know, every people had a name for those two gods, right? Just like everyone had a name for the sun god, right? So again, you've got this, your passage is talking about the king of Babylon. You know, it's actually talking about Venus. You know, so a metaphor of using that god referring to the king of Babylon, right? But the revelators are saying, yeah, if you go back to the King James, where you actually have that one and only time in the entire Bible that the word Lucifer is in there, remember, that's the only time is in that one sentence that the word Lucifer occurs in the King James Version. And you can pull that out of context, and you know, and you can use the truth of that passage, as they just did here, and you can use that name for the system sovereign. Yeah. And you go, why did they, you know, why didn't they call the system sovereign Satan? You know, why didn't they call him the bright and morning star? I mean, effectively, they did. Lucifer is the bright and morning star. But why didn't they literally call him the bright and morning star? Like they call Gabriel, you know, bright and morning star. It's because of passages like this, where if you call the system sovereign Lucifer, that passage in Isaiah in the King James Version works as a truth about the system sovereign. If they'd called the system sovereign Satan, sentences that we have that use the word Satan, they don't really apply to the system sovereign very well. They apply to the deputy of the system sovereign pretty well, so that's why they call the deputy Satan. Right? They pick a human name, you know, that the way we've used that name, maybe with a little tweaking of the sentence, works really well for that particular celestial being. Right? They were told they had to do that. They couldn't just coin a name if they could use one. So they used Lucifer. They used Satan. Oh, but they needed two more names. Right? So they had to coin Kalagastia and Dalagastia, but they didn't go very far. I mean, we call the devil the prince of darkness, right? And he's the planetary prince, like they're telling us here. Isn't that kind of why they call them planetary princes? I mean, you can have which is the chicken and which is the egg. Right, but what does Kalagastia mean? The entity that is entirely darkness. You know, Kalag is Latin for darkness. Right, I mean, they just coined a name that's effectively the Prince of Darkness. Right? But they wanted a proper name rather than, like calling him a bright morning star or a brilliant evening star. It's obvious why they called those first, you know, beings in every local universe bright morning stars instead of Lucifers. Okay, if they called them Lucifers, then this book would not be evolutional. It wouldn't be constructed in a way that conformed with our evolutionary precursors. Right? They're trying to make it conform with our evolutionary precursors. Yeah, but there's a passage, you know, in the New Testament that uses bright and morning star, and that one is easily tweakable to apply to Gabriel. Right, so. That's what they do. Now, obviously, also, you're going, well, now, wait a minute. Does it actually say in Isaiah, how are you cast down, you who dared to confuse the worlds? Right. You know it doesn't say worlds in the Old Testament like that. Right. It says nations. Right. You know, so they tweak that. It also says, you know, how are you cast down to the ground or to the earth? And they want to toss that out so it wasn't quite so, you know, so we didn't, you know, take it too literally. But like we've talked about, you know, if you do take that part of cast down to the earth, you know, it's kind of interesting that at the beginning of the 20th century, when they actually interned Satan, you know, initially you had Satan roaming through the heavens, quote unquote, until they interned him. And humans have Lucifer, Satan, Kalagastia, Dalagastia, and everyone else all blurred together into one evil being. And so effectively from our picture, if instead of having Satan around, flowing around, you know, floating around in heaven, if you take him off the heavenly stage, this one evil being is cast down to earth as Kalagastia, who is still on the earth. And so there is a truth kind of to that, that if you take the one out of heaven, you're just left with the one that's on the earth. But you notice here they threw that part out because they didn't want you to think of, they're using it for Lucifer, and Lucifer is never literally, you know. Is Lucifer on Mount Hermon with Jesus? No, he sends Satan in his stead. Right, so he's not even down to earth, you know, right? You know, there in that scene. Okay. All right. So I know that was a much ado about that, but
No, I learned a lot.
But you can see there's so many ways that you could get really confused about how the relators are using the Bible. If you just pause and reflect a minute, you know, it should be initially, I was like, oh, wait a minute, I never thought about that. Lucifer is actually a Latin word. You know, it means light bearer, right? And we used to make it a lowercase L and use it as a name for a match, right? You know, a box of Lucifers, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, they used it like that. It's just a common noun, right? You know, because a match is a little light bearer. You know, look it, I bear the light, you know, and you light the little match, right? Right. So, I mean, you know, same way with Satan, right? I mean, it's a Hebrew word, you know. No one on Gerizim is naming anyone a Hebrew name. So the moment you recognize that, it's like, oh, I got to rethink this. You know, I can't think so simplistically, factually about this. I've got to go with the flow of the truth of what they're doing here more. All right. And before we do the question, just one more thing I wanted you to know. Look at how delightful that passage from Ezekiel is there. Your heart was lifted up because of your beauty. Right? The heart, the genuine heart, is the upper domain of the hourglass, right? The temple within. See, so, you know, when the revelators use heart, they're talking about the temple, the upper domain of the hourglass analogy. That's a great passage. We can use that. We were just talking about Lucifer has this false exaltation of the upper domain going on. He fell in love with the beauty of his mind. Okay, someone a question on the webinar?
There are two. First one's from Winston. Culmination of self-respect is not self-esteem or self-love. It is just objective enough. So how do we dwell with ourselves and others if we have this false self-esteem? Do you mean that I can repent of my self-admiration?
Well, just see, it's just a matter of being humble. You'll naturally not exalt self-respect up to self-esteem or higher if you're humble. Humility will naturally make the physics work. And think about that self-respect level, the level of kindness. That level of kin-likeness, right? You just get this objective perspective. You look down on your adjutant self, and you treat it like kin, like parent to child, right? Just have that simple level of kin-likeness relationship to that self, parent to child. That's healthy, but nothing beyond that. You take it to any higher than that, it becomes negative. You remind yourself of the work is important, the self is not. Every time you're doing something, you say that, that'll make sure that self-respect doesn't get exalted into self-esteem. Simple little things like that. Just remember that it should be easy to not falsely exalt that adjutant self. Once you recognize that you're aware of this self, if you think about the revelation that tells you, and don't forget, that self dies and is not resurrected, that should short-circuit any tendency for you to falsely exalt it. It's mortal. No mortal self is ever resurrected, right? What's resurrected is that other self, the soul, that mirage self that you're not even conscious of. Right? I mean, if you just keep that in mind, you don't have to worry about any false exaltation of self, right? You probably have to work on the opposite, and not thinking of it as garbage. Okay, just because it's not resurrected doesn't mean it doesn't have value in this life, right? Don't throw it out with the garbage, baby with bathwater, like you were just saying a minute ago, right? But, you know, it's a means to a greater end. Don't bring it into relationship to eternity. See, that's the problem. See, if you exalt it, instead of being properly tied to time, you start to imagine that it's that mortal self is tied to eternity. No, it's a mortal self. It's not tied to eternity. It's not even a potentially immortal self. It's purely a mortal self. It has no connection to eternity, can't be made to have a connection to eternity. It is only in relationship to time. Don't think of it in eternal terms. Okay, another question?
Yeah, David's asking, unconscious choice and unconscious decision are phrases not found in the Rancho Books. How can we understand life and death decision, a survival choice, being totally unconscious?
Yeah, they actually are, just not verbatim like that. In paper 34, you can find parenthetically talking about two different kinds of choices, conscious and unconscious choices. But like I said, we don't want to get off. There's a lot of detail, and we've spent a lot of time in Symmetry of Soul in some of the recent arcs, expanding that. You know, all the adjuster papers. We went through all six of the adjuster papers and unpacked all of that. You know, all those details. So you know, refer to those references. You know, go to the archives of Symmetry of Soul and. There's lots of lengthy discussion about some of these issues, the nature of personality, and a lot of these things. A lot of this is very complicated. Took us many 2-hour shows to unpack some of that stuff. All right. let's see. I think we got it all there, didn't we?
Yeah.
Yep. All right.
Very little was heard of Lucifer on Urantia, owing to the fact that he assigned his first lieutenant, Satan, to advocate his cause on your planet. Satan was a member of the same primary group of Lunanodex, but had never functioned as a system sovereign. He entered fully into the Lucifer insurrection. The devil is none other than Caligastia, the deposed planetary prince of Urantia, and a son of the secondary order of Lunanodex. At the time Michael was on Urantia in the flesh, Lucifer, Satan, and Caligastia were leagued together to effect the miscarriage of his bestowal mission, but they signally failed.
Okay. We're already kind of talking about some of this, but let's just go into some of the detail a little bit more about, you know, they're the names. You know, we've got these beings, and they've got to have English names for them. They can usurp the word Lucifer and Satan. They've got to coin Caligastia. But let's look at that first name. Very little was heard of Lucifer on Urantia, owing to the fact, okay, you know, he always had his deputy, you know, as the point person on doing things. You're going, oh, is that why the word Lucifer only occurs one time in the Bible? No, that's not what they're saying, as we just described. What they're pointing out is if you go through all the various things that humans have said about apparently, you know, some evil one, you know, up to no good, you know, no matter how confused the author might have been, I mean, none of those are technically really referring to Lucifer, because just Lucifer is not an immediate player. That's what they're pointing out. You know, they're not saying that you won't find a lot of sentences that have the word Lucifer in it. You're just pointing out that none of the sentences that are talking about evil ones, they're either totally confused, or maybe they're basically referring to Satan, maybe they're basically referring to Caligastia, you know, or whatnot. So that's what they mean by that. You know, and it was this, remember, the same is true with Caligastia a lot. You know, Caligastia usually, you know, has Daligastia as the point person. I mean, that's why it's called Dalmatia, right? You don't come to the planetary headquarters to really stand side by side with the planetary prince. You stand side by side with his point person, right? And that's why it's called Dalmatia. Stand together with Daligastia, the one who actually interfaces with what's going on directly. Right, so Cal and Dal did, you know, did a similar thing, like Lucifer and Satan, in that regard. At least before the rebellion. Okay, now why did they pick the name Satan for the system sovereign's deputy? Why, you know, why did they think that that one would work? Why did they coin something for him? Okay, Satan, you know, literally is a Hebrew word that means adversary. You know, if you capitalize it, then it's the capital A adversary, right? That's all humans have done in coining that term. But see, what's the spirit, you know, of that use for the, you know, the evil one being called the adversary? It's like in a court case, right? And there's some, you know, someone is advocating on one side of the case, right? Your adversary in a court case, you know, that adversary is advocating his cause, right? Lucifer is, I mean, you know, is not the mouthpiece. He sends his deputy out. He's the one that's actually directly advocating, you know, in Lucifer's stead. See, so it just naturally works just by the name to use it. And then also there are times when a human sentence has the word Satan in it instead of devil that works well with the deputy, you know, system administrator as opposed to the planetary prince. So they just, you know, looking at all those various issues, they decided, yeah, this works with more or less distortion of meaning. So let's call the deputy Satan. And then they just, you know, continue on with that. You know, Satania is the nation of adversity, the place of adversity. Right? Again, it's not the place of Satan. You know. I mean, how illogical would it be to call a local system after the deputy? If you're going to call it after one of the leaders, would you call it after the system sovereign? I mean, see, obviously, it's not being named after the deputy administrator. It's using the Hebrew word again. It's the nation of adversity, the place of adversity, Satania. Okay, and I already told you about Caligastia. See, Calig is darkness. As, you know, the word as means entirely, you know, in a literal sense. And then he has so fallen that they don't want to even give him a personal suffix. You know, they don't use an IA suffix. They use the impersonal TIA suffix. You know, so they don't want you to read that literally as the being who is entirely darkness, the entity that is entirely darkness, right? And no, you know, the being that is entirely darkness and no longer personal, right? I.e. the entity that is entirely darkness, by purposely using that impersonal suffix that they coined. Remember, you know, English doesn't have the TIA suffix. They coined that. Just like we take the ION suffix and coin the TION suffix. With that that Latin T, from the past participle in Latin constructs. So anyway, they needed a suffix to use in personal sense, and so they use it for him just to poke at him. Not even going to give you a personal designation, you know, Prince of Darkness. I'm sure he did not like that little coinage.
I wondered if he appreciated it.
Because he understands the coinage literally. Okay, so you got that. Let's see. But they signally failed. Just kind of pointing out that they kind of made themselves the textbook example of failure. You think about why would they use that word signaling like that?
Poster kids.
Right. Yeah. So failed just, you know, in such just classic terms, of pitifulness. Okay, all right, and then they're going to give us this next one. They've got a couple of the beings that they need to give names to. So let's read that one.
Abaddon,
It's actually Abaddon.
Oh, excuse me, Abaddon. Oh, a bad guy. Abaddon was chief of the staff of Caligastia. He followed his master into rebellion and has ever since acted as chief executive of the Urantia rebels. Beelzebub was the leader of the disloyal Midway creatures who allied themselves with the forces of the traitorous Caligastia.
Okay, so now Beelzebub, it's actually, he's technically a secondary Midwayer, if you remember from, when they talk about the disloyal Midwayers.
Does that mean he's not here anymore?
He's not here anymore. Right. Beelzebub was taken off at Pentecost. The Beelzebub one, is an interesting one because, see, when you're talking about secondary Midwayers, now remember, secondary Midwayers, obviously, probably even more so, the disloyal ones, were interacting with humans all the time. And so you have to actually kind of wonder if humans, actually coined that descriptive name, sort of Lord of the Flies or, Lord of the Dung Heap, right? As and a direct negative term, coinage against this rebel secondary Midwayer that was fooling around with humans all the time, and making a mess out of things. That one, the humans may have actually called him that.
He was a demon.
Yeah, he quote unquote a demon. Yeah, right. That one's, you're not quite sure. If they've just kind of taken that name. Because, of course, now these days, we call the devil Beelzebub and Lucifer. And say, we blur all these names together. But that one, there's a little bit of a chicken and egg thing. You wonder there if that isn't just the revelators taking that name and applying it to to that leader. But them just kind of reminding you that, and that name you use, you guys actually came up with that for that leader of the Midwayers. That may be the case. But the other one now, and it's Abaddon because there's two D's. Right? See, so it's not Abaddon. Yeah. Yeah, that would be one D. It's and you can look that up in the dictionary because Abaddon in Hebrew or Apollyon. Or Apollyon in Greek. You're reading in Revelation and you come upon that where, this individual that's related to the bottomless pit, the abyss, and destruction in that story in the Bible, okay, is called Abaddon in Hebrew, and they say, or in Greek, Apollyon. They decided to go, rather than using the Greek one, they used the Hebrew one, Abaddon. Okay, but you've got this chief of staff of Caligastia. And remember, I've referred to this several times. When you're reading about the planetary, the planetary princes, and about the Lunanodex, you're going, huh, sometimes there's a tertiary Lunanodex that assists the planetary prince. And I wonder if this is a tertiary Lunanodex. You're what?
Abaddon.
Maybe that's my suspicion. And one of the reasons that you're even more suspicious that this chief of staff is not, the normal assistants, the seraphim and stuff like that. Because remember, all the rebel Midwayers and all the rebel angels, seraphim, cherubim, the unnamed order of angels, all the rebel angels and all the rebel Midwayers were taken off at Pentecost. Abaddon, obviously, was not taken off. Right? He was chief of staff, back when you had the whole thing going. But it isn't just a past tense thing. Right? He followed, past tense, his master into rebellion, and has ever since acted, right, as chief executive of the Urantia rebels, right? I try to stress that all the time. People miss that. It's like, oops, wait a minute. This is a nut. He's on the planet still. Kalagash and Dalagash are here. You know, and all of the non-angel midway or other rebels are also here. And we don't know who they are, but see, there's obviously a group of them. I mean, Abaddon, you know, isn't chief of staff of no one. I mean, chief executive, I mean, of no one.
How long do you think they'll be here?
And apparently, you know, until the rebellion is adjudicated, or, you know, or maybe even Machiavelli assumes, you know, planetary spread, or, you know, you can speculate, who knows. But they are here right now. Yep.
This is their last chance to do this kind of evil and destruction. Their next stop is a detention world, right?
Right. I mean, either, you know, things will be, the rebellion will be adjudicated and they'll just be, executed by the executioners of the Ancients of Days, or there would be some intermediate thing where they would be taken off like the rebel midwayers and Sarah and angels have been. You know, and put it on the prison worlds.
But this is their last hurrah.
Yeah, I mean, right, other than, you know, potentially being imprisoned on the prison worlds, if you can call that a last hurrah.
But they don't have any more power.
Right, and again, remember, see the thing, you know, they took off all the beings that have any sort of immediacy to us. Right? You know, so now, you know, none of these beings can do anything to you. I mean, they certainly can't, you know, make themselves physically manifest like a secondary midwayer could.
But they have various plans that they carry.
They have all kinds of various things, and you know, and if you you can, you know, you have spiritual force fields that prevent any of them from doing anything to you. But you know, you can willingly drop those, right? You have absolute free will, right? You know, they can't poke you with a spear, right? But if you drop the force field, they can touch your mind. And you know, and if they touch your mind, that's it. You know, if any of these evil beings, you know, that's the thing. You know, under no circumstances, you know, should you cultivate, you know, any sort of a visionary thing as a religious experience. I mean, if you actually aren't just delusionally playing around in the lower domain of the hourglass, if you actually get your personality involved, you actually get your free will involved, and you know, really are working in the upper domain. And decide, I want to go outside of this protected, safe domain that's been created for me. It's like, well, it was created by the Creative Mother Spirit. You can't just go outside. Yes, I can. I have absolute free will. If I want to go outside, I can. Well, on a normal world, that might just be kind of confusing and pointless or whatever. On this world, under no circumstances do you want to do that. Because the moment you poke yourself outside of that safe zone, right? I mean, these beings, that's why they say under no circumstances even think about attempting that sort of a thing. Just don't go there. Right? I mean, if, you know, on this world, if you actually achieve that, if you actually get yourself willfully outside of the protection of the Holy Spirit, the Spirit of Truth, and the Thought Adjuster, that little space that, you know, is safe. I mean, these beings have nothing to do 24/7, 365, except wait for someone to do that. Right. You won't have a second. They'll be right there. Right. And if, you know, all they have to do is just touch your mind, and you're scrambled. It doesn't matter how much you instantly try to pull yourself back in, you'll never be the same. You'll be in institutions the rest of your life. That's why they're so definitive in the adjuster's papers about that. Okay, you do not want to actually achieve this. Remember how they say, you know, they can't do anything to you unless you willingly, right? I want to be, you know, right. I mean, you can use your free will to put yourself out there. Under no circumstances try such foolishness. You've got your entire universe career to work on, you know, trying to project yourself, you know, outside of your immediate, you know, localization and stuff. You do not want to be attempting that here, right? Because if you really achieve it, right, you won't get the fairy tale of your imagination in this quote unquote soul journey, or however you just, you know, you're imagining what the heck you're doing is. You're gonna get one of these people right there, right? And you'll feel this horrendous dark presence, and you can't pull back fast enough. If you feel it, they've touched you, right? Right. You'll be struggling the rest of your life to try to maintain some sort of sanity. You'll be in institutions, in and out of institutions. They'll be giving you electric shock therapy. You're not going to recover. And I say that very definitively because I know a couple of people that have described these things, and you could tell they weren't just delusional. And you can tell physically they weren't delusional about this because of how they've spent the rest of their life in institutions and scrambled. And they actually describe. I felt like I was starting to move out, and it felt like they were already kind of a ways out. But see, really, they're just kind of moving to the periphery of their inner domain. And they said, and then I started to really feel, and then all of a sudden I felt this really dark presence, and I quickly pulled back.
Not quick enough.
You can't pull back quick enough. All right, so under no circumstances.
So they've become totally precarious now. They're not even...
Right, I mean, they've got nothing to do but just try to scramble you, right? They can't touch you materially.
Just because they
can touch you mindily if you put yourself outside of the shields. Right?
So they're real psychopaths.
Yeah, right. They're very nefarious, right?
Get pleasure in that? Yeah. Got nothing else to do. Was it wait for somebody to bend?
Right. I mean, they still think that this is the thing to do. When you take it to that point of recognition, it becomes an interesting. It's like, well, why on earth wouldn't they take them off? I mean, what if you're just this, ignorant person, like we all are, and you just got caught up, you had this guru that told you you could do this really groovy spiritual journey thing, and the next thing you spend the rest of your life in an institution. I mean, doesn't God love us enough to prevent that from happening? No, that's not the universe. God didn't go in there and prevent the rebels from corrupting people in the first mansion world, like we were talking about back there, right? The rebels went to the first mansion world, these poor ascenders, they just barely made it off of their nativity sphere. It was pre-bestowal sun in that world. Everyone in that world didn't get an adjuster by grace. They clawed their way up to a third circle or maybe they got this incredible gift, of an adjuster for reasons that the revelers aren't not even totally understand. Got to the first mansion world, and there's a rebel meeting them and takes them to iniquity. Right. Right. That's what we talked about that. I mean, can you love a God that would allow that to happen? You can love a fairy tale God. Can you love the real God that made an evolutionary domain where innocent first mansion world ascenders get caught up in a rebellion and instead of ending up on the Isle of Paradise, end up as nothing? No.
Does this have anything to do with the so-called out-of-body experience that most of Boulder talks about?
We're not talking about. We're not talking about just this, remote viewing sort of a thing, we're not talking about when an adjuster leaves and comes back, and that's interpreted as you leaving and come back or anything like that. we're talking about like what the revelators warn you about in the adjuster papers, you know, of you just actually, you know, the mind energy system is ubiquitous, right? You're not forced to stay in the localized domain in the mind energy system that you're put in by grace. You can use your free will, right, to push out further. And you don't want to do that. Right? And that's what I say. If you actually, if what you're doing is just a spiritual experience, you may think you're in the upper domain, but you're really in the lower domain, and it's all just delusional and it's harmless. Right? But they say, if you achieve it as a religious experience, right? Personal spiritual experience, if your personality is actually involved, if the upper domain is involved, right? I mean, Abaddon or Caligastia, they don't have agitant mind. You can't get to them horizontally from the lower domain of the hourglass, right? But you can get to them horizontally from the upper domain, right? You can meet them eye to eye up there. Don't want to do that. All right. Okay, so that's, you know, that's the interesting thing about Abaddon. Probably is he a tertiary Lenonidek, and he's here. And, you know, the other people are here. You're wondering, like we've talked about before, are they other people that were part of Caligash's staff that were not seraphim? Were some of them visitors? I brought that up, you know. How many visitors were on the world 200,000 years ago that were not, you know, seraphim, say? That would have, if they joined the rebellion, they would have been taken off. You know, there could be all kinds of beings that aren't even revealed to us in the revelation that might have been here as a visitor, but are low enough to get caught up in a rebellion. They'd still be here. Apparently, Abaddon is, you know, chief executive over that little cadre of rebel beings, whoever they are. Okay? All right.
The dragon eventually became the symbolic representation of all these evil personages. Upon the triumph of Michael, Gabriel came down from Salvington and bound the dragon, all the rebel leaders, for an age. Of the Jerusalem seraphic rebels, it is written, and the angels who kept not their first estate, but left their own habitation, he has reserved and sure chains of darkness to the judgment of the great day.
That last line, you know, is pretty, that last quote, yeah, is pretty straight, again, out of that passage in Jude that they referred to before. You know, so they're going, okay, yeah, that works pretty well.
What's an age?
Wait, what was that?
What's an age?
Oh, well, again, it's relative to, you know, just yeah. However long it is, you know, until, you know, the adjudication.
And Salmagin was not in a court.
Right, and that's the other thing, of course, that's really funny. It's like, I bet it doesn't say Gabriel came down from Salmagin. Right. Right. See, so again, you can see, it should be pretty obvious. They're not, when they have quotes in the book, they're not factual quotes. You know, none of the quotes in the part four are factual quotes. They're not factually quoting the Bible in part four or any other place in the book. They're quoting it truthfully. It's a revelation of truth.
So Matthew didn't find this quote. sorry, Matt.
And, you know, here you probably, you know, when you see the dragon thing, oh, I bet I know where that is. Can anyone guess what book of the Bible is probably talking about?
Revelation.
The dragon, yeah, Revelation, right? It's from the book of Revelation, yeah, obviously. Yeah, so they're just, and again, right, you know how, you know, dark fairy tale-like a lot of that stuff in the book of Revelation is. And as they tell us, in the, you know, here in the fifth epical Revelation, you know, John actually did have a vision. He actually was shown, you know, by his adjuster, some representations of Gerasim and Salvington and whatnot. But there's all sorts of other, you know, stuff that got blended into the book of Revelation, you know, besides just, you know, how well could John even interpret, you know, what he was, you know, what the, his adjuster gave him visions of. You know, and so you have these very, you know, kind of typical material anthropomorphic sorts of stories, you know, in there about dragons and, you know, and four horsemen and the apocalypse and what have you, right? You know, and they're just pointing out, yeah, even something that is seemingly, you know, not valid like that, if you just allow it to go beyond its immediacy, there's a truth flowing through that. You know, just let the dragon stand for all the rebel leaders. And you've got a statement that you can tweak a little bit, throw in Gabriel and Salvington, and right? And again, it's like, well, why do they go to such lengths like that? Why not just say something? I mean, why go to that sentence in the Bible and completely reword it and what have you, and tell you that you can think of the dragon as, you know, the symbolic representation? It's like, again, that's the mandate, the revelatory mandate. Right? They're not allowed to say anything out of their own creative mind if they can find a sequence of human words that will serve the purpose. Even if that sequence of human words is fraught with potential for more distortion of meaning. Right? Right? So again, you got to remember that about the way, you know, they're not allowed to directly quote Jesus in part four. It's a violation of the revelatory mandate. If they can find, you know, someone that captured the essence of what he said, Paul, say, or someone, they have to use that sequence of words. You know, or if there's a sequence of words in the Bible, you know, that Nathan wrote or whatever, they have to use that sequence of words. They're not allowed to take, you know, what Jesus said in Aramaic, say, and just directly translate it into English. Yeah, you know, it's like, well, how do you know? Well, because it just tells you that point blank up there, and they talk about how the book is constructed.
Unless there is no expression.
Right? I mean, occasionally they're, you know, they may have pretty directly given you what Jesus said, you know, translated into English, right? But that's the last resort, right? And you got to remember that, right? That's why you're going along and you see Jesus said, quote unquote, and if you know the Bible, you go, what do you mean Jesus said? That's a quote out of Corinthians. Paul said that. And you go, well, whoever wrote this book is, you know, total stupid. I mean, they think I'm an idiot. I mean, I'll fall for anything. No, you know. The error is not in the book, or the error is in you. You have a false initial assumption. You're assuming that they're quoting fact. You know, and on top of that, you didn't read the passage that described how they constructed the book. They tell you point blank how they constructed it. Okay. So, you know, you've got to recognize it. Stop being so grasping of the words. Right? The words are merely facts. And it's not a revelation of facts. It's a revelation of truth. The whole point is to find the truth that's flowing through that passage Jesus said. It's not to literally think that Jesus said that and reverence his words and memorize them. Right? That's a fetish. You're making a fetish out of those words. Don't do that. Right? You know, they're trying to get us to stop making a fetish. I mean, why didn't Jesus leave anything written? Because humans would just made a fetish out of anything he left in written text. Yeah. Right. We would all be circling it right now, you know. You know, doing hosannas, you know, about this sentence, you know. I mean, it would be so hopeless. Right? We would care, you know. If humans think that they've got the actual words of Jesus, they could care less about truth. They just want to worship the fact of the words of Jesus Christ. Right?
Which kind of goes into what you were saying earlier about, you know, in terms of sometimes it's better to not always be so smart about things, you know, or to be able, because you can get the truth better without knowing all the facts.
You can be befogged by much thinking. Yes. You know, and it's easy to be befogged by much thinking to the point where even when Jesus is corporeally standing in the same room with you, he looks at you and says, there's nothing I can do with you, I'm sorry. Did he try to help that teacher in the Alexandrian library that was befogged by much thinking? No, he just, you know, whispered to Gannett, there's nothing we can do here.
Our work is finished here.
Right? Do you want to be just like that?
Yeah.
Well, where you have enough intellect to be befogged by much thinking and the master would have to pass you by? Right? It's just, so try to be humble, especially if you have a lot of intellect. Especially if you were genetically born smart, you got to really work on trying to be humble. Because you can so easily fall in love with your ability to rationalize everything and think about, write about things in cool ways, you know.
You really can't be very smart anyway.
Right, it's all relative. It will appear that you're right. But, you know, that's, so just, you know, there's all of these cautionary tales that we can talk about. And, The whole, like I said, I mean, besides the whole bit about the Lucifer Rebellion, just the use of quotes in this section is really helpful just to spend some time on, to try to get you on a better footing, you know, so that when you're reading something, especially that doesn't have quote marks about it, you go, wait a minute, that's almost word for word out of this book from, you know, 1915. This thing is a plagiary. No, it's not. Right, it's a revelation of truth. The point is not that sequence of words. What's the truth that's flowing through those words? The truth that's flowing through those words is not copyrighted. Right, you're looking for the truth, not the fact. Right, don't. It's not a sacred text. Don't turn the words into fetishes. Learn to be fluid, so that you can go with the truth of what's being said. All right. One section.
For another section.
All right. Let's take
next
a moment.
One's shorter.
Yeah. The next one's a little more straightforward, too. So we'll probably get to the Lucifer Manifesto next time as well. All right. Let's take a moment here, everyone.